Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Well, first of all, let me say it's a great pleasure to be here to discuss these matters of international criminal law and to thank Professor Morten Bertsmo for the invitation to be here. I'd like to start out by a note on the method I used to write this paper, which I guess could also be interpreted as a disclaimer on what I'm about to say. First of all, I guess the origins of this paper, this proposition, was an article I wrote a few years ago criticizing the use of the criminal law dogmatic to try to explain matters of international criminal law. And I think the best example comes from command responsibility. When criminal law theorists try to explain command responsibility, they have to look at things like omissions, neglect, but these concepts of domestic criminal law don't really fit in nicely with these new ideas and these new modes of responsibility that we find in international criminal law. This paper was not very well received, as you might imagine. But it came to a point where I said, well, I have to stop being critical and maybe I should start making a proposal. So about a year ago, I started working on a theory of international criminal law. And I gave great thought to how to start this new project. And I came to the conclusion that it would probably be better if I started by pointing out some general principles of international criminal law and maybe start from there. So again, this is a disclaimer. This is only a proposal, which of course I look forward to your comments on how this is shaping up. I have to give credit. I have to give credit to Professor Rolando Tamayo. He's a professor in Mexico City that has worked a lot on the method of law theory, and he basically, and I'm really being very simplistic when I say this, he basically proposes that we should use an inductive method to come up with general principles. And for this to be a legal theory, the basis, the object of study must be legal norms. Now, again, when I say this, this means that there's really no philosophical component to what I'm about to say. It's a normative theory that I'm proposing, and it's simply that. How do I approach this? Well, if I'm going to say this is a normative theory, then I have to identify the sources of law, which will be from where I will derive these general principles. So when it comes to international criminal law, this basically takes us back to treaties and case law. Now, you can also make an argument that customary international law is part of what can be used to build upon a theory. However, I make a special point of deriving this theory from the Rome Statute. And the reason I do this is that it's the only treaty that really has a very comprehensive substantive international law norms embedded in its text. You have other treaties, for instance, the torture treaties, forced disappearance treaties, that really just give you a criminal definition of a crime, of the particular crime they're seeking to regulate. However, only the Rome Statute has other things like modes of responsibility, defenses, and what we really come to think of as a comprehensive criminal law system. Of course, it has some other things, but this is what I'm really focusing on. I also think it's important because of the high number of ratifications of treaty has. It has a lot of member states, and even when you look at countries that have not become party to the Rome Statute, the objections are really not based on the criminal law that it's there. It really has a lot to do with jurisdictional issues, the role of the Security Council, but nobody seems to oppose an objection to what's really, strictly speaking, substantive criminal law. Now, I should also say from the start that there's a historical context to this paper. There's a historical context to this paper because we really have to go back to the Nuremberg precedent. And this was, I really don't want to spend that much time on this particular issue because it was talked yesterday. A lot of the speakers talked about the importance of the Nuremberg principles and the Nuremberg trial for international criminal law. However, I do want to say one thing. You may criticize what I call the Nuremberg experience for what it stood for at the time, but the one conclusion that was reached there is that we have something called international criminal responsibility. And as it was said before yesterday, there's a real, there's a distinction, a clear-cut distinction between state responsibility and international criminal responsibility, but I also argue that there's a distinction between international criminal responsibility and criminal responsibility in a domestic or national setting. I will continue this argument later on. Now, what's important about the concept of international criminal responsibility is that it really forces us to think of, well, when are we gonna say that somebody is criminal or responsible. Now, I don't really think that the Nuremberg principles are principles at all. I really don't think that they're actually legal norms. It's just guidelines, really. However, these guidelines set a minimum standard of what should be included in international criminal law. And that's where I pose these questions. Which crimes? Which modes of responsibility? Which responsibilities will be excluded? Which defenses should be included in international criminal law? And this really derives from the idea, the notion that there's something out there called international criminal responsibility. So we have to say when somebody is and when someone is not criminally responsible. And that's really the value I see in the Nuremberg principles. Now, the way I approach this paper is, like I already said, to distinguish international criminal responsibility from state responsibility, and what may sound a bit more controversial, from national criminal responsibility. And this I do to prove that it's its own entity with its own characteristics. Now this, like I said, is fairly easy when you distinguish it from state responsibility because it's really not a subject that seems to be up for debate, really, at least not after Nuremberg. There is a coexistence between both forms of responsibility, and this translates into different jurisdictional entities that establish when a state or a person is responsible. We all know, this may seem simplistic, but we all know that you cannot judge a state before the ICC. And you cannot take a person before the International Court of Justice or regional courts such as the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. although some of the past judges of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights seem to not grasp this idea very well. The one thing that really stands out, it's the mental element. When you look, for instance, and again, I remind you, this is a normative theory. When you look at the articles on state responsibility, the one element that is missing is the mental element. And that makes perfect sense, because states are not people and they cannot make decisions by themselves. But it's there, and it's a key difference between these forms of responsibility. Now, I'd like to take more time in these further matters. You have the distinctions between international criminal responsibility and national criminal responsibility. Now, the first point you have in the slide, you can read, protection of international legal interests. I looked at the program, and I know that this is referred to as legal goods. I'm really not convinced. That just seems like a very literal translation of the original term. And I debated where I should change it, the slide and say legal goods, but then I said, no, why should I? Perhaps I will have to do this in editing, but I will not do it right now. I do believe that if we talk about legal interests, it's really a broader concept that is truer, I think, to the meaning of what we really want to protect in criminal law and international criminal law. Now, I will argue here, that what distinguishes national from international responsibility is in part the legal goods or legal interests that are involved. International criminal law should only protect international legal interests. And this will help distinguish from what should be this international legal goods at the national setting. International crimes are international crimes for two reasons. Because they are based in a source of international law, but also because they protect an international interest. And this helps distinguish between what should go before an international tribunal, before the ICC, or a domestic tribunal like Indian, Mexican, or any other national tribunal. Now, the forms of liability are also important here. I already mentioned command responsibility, but through the history of international criminal law, we've come up with other modes of responsibility, such as joint criminal enterprise. The ICC is really, I'm going to say, experimenting with co-perpetration. These are modes of responsibility or liability which are very particular to international criminal law, and we really don't see these in national jurisdictions. I know that there's some scholars that have said that, for instance, joint criminal enterprise is really conspiracy. I really don't believe that. I think there's more to joint criminal enterprise than simple conspiracy, the mere agreement to commit a crime. Now, I also believe that what is distinct of international criminal responsibility is that it's a group responsibility. Now, we all know that it's the person and the individual who goes before trial is eventually sentenced and punished for an international crime. But this person never acts alone. If you look at the crimes such as genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, it's virtually impossible to commit these outside of a group setting. Now, theoretically, this can happen, but it really doesn't happen. There's always a group, and might be a big group, might be an army, might be a paramilitaries, might be political parties even, but there's always a group behind that where the person that commits the crime is involved. And the modes of responsibility that I alluded to, such as command responsibility, such as joint criminal enterprise, really support this notion, because there must be a group in order for a person to command or not to command somebody in the context of command responsibility or to be part of an enterprise. So there's always group responsibility involved in international criminal law. And although we have some notions of this at the domestic setting, for instance, organized crime, it doesn't happen all the time, but it does in international criminal law. Now, the other aspect I wanted to talk about is the mental element. And in the slide, you can see that this is I mentioned a mental element, but also blameworthiness. Now, when you use the concept culpability in English and you refer to common law, it really is just the notion that there must be a mental element involved. But I believe that international criminal law is involved with a moral choice. There must be a moral choice of the person who commits the crime. And although I haven't really found any literature to support this, the closest I came up with in English is blameworthiness. Now, this moral choice, which I talk about, was first present in the Tadic judgment, nullum crimen sine culpa. The elements of the crimes also talk about value judgments. And one of my favorite decisions of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, Fermín Ramírez versus Guatemala, talks about culpability or blameworthiness as a human right derived from the principle of legality. And as it was mentioned in an earlier lecture, human rights are part of international criminal law and the Rome Statute. Now, what do I understand, or what would be the meaning of blameworthiness? Now, I go back to Luigi Ferrajoli, who I like his definition for two reasons. First of all, because he's one of the greatest proponents of minimal criminal law, which is, I think, always a good idea. And the other reason is because in his definition, he takes into account both the common law tradition and the civil law tradition. And he basically says that blameworthiness is a link between the decision to commit the crime, the conduct or act or omission, and the result. The capacity of the person to understand and wish to carry out the conduct, and this is very close to that moral judgment I was talking about, and the concrete conscience and will to carry out the crime. Now, he takes these two traditions and comes up with this definition, or these characteristics of blameworthiness, which, again, this is open to debate, but it's the closest, I think, that really takes into account these two legal traditions. Now, I started my presentation by saying that international criminal responsibility is a foundational principle. And the reason I say this is because once you establish this concept, other principles naturally derive from it. And here I mention a few that are explained further in this study I was talking about. First of all, international mental element. What I found is that, at least in the civil law tradition, the mental element is linked with the crime, with the elements of the crime. However, when we looked at the Rome Statute and we look at the case law, what I call international mental element goes beyond that. when you look at the modes of responsibility, there's always a mental element in there. As a matter of fact, joint criminal enterprise as such was rejected in their own statute, but it was somehow included with a mental element in Article 25, 2D. And it's also present in the defenses. When you look at the Rome Statute, there's really the one common denominator is that there is the mental element. Is there or isn't there a mental element? Was the person capable of moral choice or not? So I think what I call international mental element goes beyond what we know or understand in a domestic setting. I also think that this is another principle which I'm working on is what I call mass violence. And this is a term I use to substitute the term mass atrocity, which you might be more familiar with. I think the term atrocity sets the bar too high. There are certain instances, certain situations, to use the term of the Rome Statute, which really don't amount to mass atrocity. However, they can still amount to, say, crimes against humanity or war crimes. And I think the Kenya situation is a good example. What the Kenyan situation boils down to is violence after an election. That is not necessarily mass atrocity, but it is mass violence. And mass violence can only be achieved by a group of individuals, hence the link with group responsibility, which I mentioned before. A single individual cannot commit mass violence. It needs the support of a group. And this is where I link the two notions. I also think there's a principle called international criminal justice. And this might be somewhat controversial as well. International criminal justice, and I really don't like this, has been equated with the fight against impunity. It seems that if we don't send somebody to prison, there was no justice. And I really don't agree with this notion. I think there's more to it, and I think there's other ways of achieving justice without a criminal justice system. So, a preliminary definition of international criminal justice would be fight against impunity, I don't question that, by eliminating unnecessary obstacles to criminal investigation and trials, while striking a balance between the rights of the accused and the interests of the victim, through independent, impartial, and democratic institutional adjudication or through other means which satisfy the interests of peace and access to justice. And this last part of the definition allows for amnesties, for instance, truth commissions, other alternative methods to achieve justice. Again, this is a working definition, but I don't like the idea of equating fight against impunity with justice, let alone international criminal justice. There are other concepts which I don't think are as widespread in their own statute or in international criminal law as such as mass victimization. But this can be linked to mass responsibility, to group responsibility. If you look at the crimes in the Rome Statute, there's always a lot of victims, mass victimization. Now, this needs a lot of work on the concept, on how this might actually be a principle which overrides or is part of the international system, but it's definitely linked to the concept of international criminal responsibility, which I suggest. Also, and as you can see, it's in quotations, the concept of peace, security, and well-being of the world. This is taken from the preamble of the Rome Statute. It just seems very vague. What really is that? It's taken from international law, I know that. But when you when you bring it into an international law setting, as the ICC is, then you have to give it a more concrete meaning. Now, this might actually be a legal interest or legal good for some, but in any way, if you're going to seek peace, again, you can't do it by yourself. There's groups involved. And the same can be said about security and well-being of the world. So there's always this concept of group responsibility behind or immersed in the concept of individual responsibility. Now, and with this I will conclude. This is the definition, this working definition, of international criminal responsibility. The possibility to punish individuals for violations of international law. I don't like the word possibility, but it's what I came up with so far. Understood both formally, that means it must be in a source of international law, and materially, which means that it must protect an international interest. With the elements of a conduct, actus reus, which, by the way, I think it's a very underappreciated concept in international criminal law. We all look at the mental element, but there's really a lot to be said about the conduct element. And committed with intent. Now, we know in the Rome Statute, intent is pretty much is dolus, because there is no neglect in Article 30, although there are some exceptions in some of the other articles. But let's just keep it broadly. Just mention this broadly, intent, which, as you can see there, is equated to mens rea or mental element. I really don't like the term mens rea. I like the term mental element better. But since I used actus reus before, well, I might as well use mens rea when I talk about intent. And the possibility of moral choice. I don't think we can really just conclude that intent is all that's needed. I think that there is an element of blameworthiness, of moral choice. I don't go into depth on this issue now, but if you read the paper, and I would greatly appreciate if you did, you can see that I go through several articles of their own statute where I believe that moral choice is necessary for criminal responsibility, and always in a group context. Again, this is derived not only from the crimes that are part of the jurisdiction of the court, but also the modes of responsibility which are particularly embedded in international criminal law and considered in the Rome Statute. Now, I know your counter-argument could be that, well, these are not the only modes of responsibility, you know. But these are the ones that are most used, and they're the ones that are originated in international criminal law. And even when you look at the cases of the International Criminal Court, and you look at some of the modes such as ordering to commit a crime, or to actually directly commit a crime, when you look at the facts, this always takes place within a group. So even when you look at the modes of liability that are used in particular cases, and you look further, you realize that even those particular cases always come up or are always present in a group context. So this is a suggested definition, and I really look forward to your comments and criticisms. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.